Hello and welcome to a new T-Rex Talk. This one is kind of an interesting one. If you clicked on this because of the title, good for you. If you clicked on this in spite of the title, good for you. We're talking about the gun industry for a couple of reasons. One is that SHOT Show is very, very soon, and I've been thinking quite a bit about SHOT Show, looking at other folks that are there trying to make a plan for what we're doing at SHOT Show. But the other reason we're talking about this particular topic is this is a request from someone at T-Rex. And this idea actually comes from Open Source Defense. So I'm actually going to begin by telling you to go back. If you're not subscribed to Open Source Defense, you should be. But about a year ago, they posted an article in their newsletter talking about an observation about Coca-Cola from Andy Warhol. Now, I'm not a super big Coke fan or Andy Warhol fan, but they made a fascinating point. Even Andy Warhol made a fascinating point. The title of that newsletter was Good Products Are Good. The Best Products Are Good and Affordable. And they start their article by saying, I'm not going to just read the whole article, by the way, you can check it out. It was the November 2021 issue of that newsletter. They start out by saying, as guns continue to attract a wider audience, the products are getting better. That makes intuitive sense. A bigger, more engaged audience increases the return on innovation, which in turn attracts innovators. But products getting better isn't just a vague trend, it has a specific meaning. What better means is higher value per dollar. And this is one of the things that I want to talk about. What are the standards by which the gun industry should be improving products, or improving perception of products, or improving their goals so that they can actually know whether or not they're meeting them and all that that implies. But what Andy Warhol is talking about is a very interesting observation about Coca-Cola, kind of the company, but mostly Coca-Cola, the specific drink. I can't even remember how big Coca-Cola was when he would have made this observation. This is late 50s, early 60s that he said, "What is great about this country is that America started the tradition where the richest consumers buy essentially the same things as the poorest." That's not something that modern liberals would get behind, but I think it is a fascinating thought. And he goes on, "You can be watching TV and see Coca-Cola, and you know that the president drinks Coke, Liz Taylor drinks Coke, and just think, you can drink Coke too. A Coke is a Coke, and no amount of money can get you a better Coke than the one that the bum on the corner is drinking. All the Cokes are the same, and all the Cokes are good. Liz Taylor knows it, the president knows it, the bum knows it, and you know it." And this is really a fascinating idea. That article by Open Source Defense goes on to talk about things that have kind of reached Coke levels of affordability and excellence and ubiquity. And that includes things like polymer-framed, striker-fired 9mm handguns. Glock is the obvious example. And then certain types of ammunition. And then there's a bunch of stuff that hasn't quite reached that level, like suppressors. And then there's things that are very far from reaching that level, like night vision. But a lot of things are moving in this general direction. So let's dive into what are some of the lessons that we can learn from Coke in general. Now, I will say right off the bat, there's basically three things that I want to talk about. The first is manufacturing. When it comes to manufacturing, that is a major part of the Coke strategy. Being able to bottle enough Coke to sell to like 75% of the world, literally billions of people. Now, I talked about manufacturing a bit last week, but again, it's kind of where my head's at. The third lesson is going to be research. How do you actually research what to do? Coke has some good and bad lessons there. And then the third is marketing. So we're going to talk about those things in that order. And these are not entirely my own ideas. I'm going to disagree with Andy Warhol on a few things, but one of them is that Coke isn't actually good. Today, it's just a high fructose corn syrup delivery system. But the point of this article is really good. Mass manufacture and the ability to make things really well and really consistency is actually going to improve product quality. So even though what Coke is selling you, you know, a recreational flavor beverage, that's kind of not the point. They're selling you a very consistent, high-quality product produced in such massive quantities that by the time you made that observation, Coke was globally available. And as this product quality improves, the disparity between high-end products and low-end products becomes really, really minimal. Now, obviously, in the beverage space, there are going to be, you know, 50-year-old wines that are incredibly expensive, and people think that they're better than cheap wines from the grocery store. And, you know, they are. There will always be luxury items, and there will always be luxury devices, but we're talking about kind of mass adoption. Coke was able in the early 20th century to simultaneously make a better product and a cheaper product and a larger quantity of product than their competitors. You know, business success would be doing any one of these things, but Coke did all three of these things at the same time. And this analogy of Coke to guns is not perfect. It kind of breaks down, sort of like a car analogy. Also, cars are another example of this. Today, even cheap cars will have the same features that expensive cars do a lot of the times. Luxury cars are no longer the best driving, longest lasting, highest quality cars on the road. They just have the most cushy features. There are features that used to be exclusive to luxury cars, and now even the cheap cars actually have those in a lot of cases. But this example is not perfect either, because the car industry doesn't really exist in a free market. There's a whole bunch of features that are on cars simply because they are mandated. There are a whole bunch of car companies that have to innovate within extremely narrow constraints defined by government regulations or union stuff. And, you know, even Coke has some monopoly stuff going on. So it got its start during the Prohibition times when a lot of its beverage competition was illegal. People point to that. That may not be a really significant factor, though, because Prohibition accomplished none of its goals. Americans consumed far more alcohol during Prohibition than the years previous and started far more alcohol trafficking, or rather distribution channels than had existed prior. So I don't know that Coke actually got a significant boost by Prohibition, even though that was kind of the point of soft drinks replacing hard drinks at the time. But during World War II, there was a significant growth of Coca-Cola. It was being sold in about 44 countries by the time that World War II started. And during World War II, Eisenhower actually begged Coke to supply Coca-Cola to GIs, partly as a way of increasing morale, but partly as a way to give them something to drink besides all of the captured hooch that they were finding in the European theater. And so Coca-Cola built 64 bottling plants essentially right behind the front lines. They actually had logistics engineers embedded with frontline units, kind of like journalists, to help plan out where they were going to build these bottling plants and how they were going to be part of the logistics chain, which is kind of fascinating to read about. And then, you know, in the 90s, all the soda companies, not just Coke, got very heavily involved in the government. They were very much involved in the USDA and sort of nutrition systems, and they got lobbyists to go out and get them more and more corn syrup subsidies and exemptions from the sugar tax, and to make sure that you could always, always buy sugary soda pop with food stamps, because it would be racist not to let people to do that. And I'm not actually making this up. This is entirely well-documented history. So yeah, the big Coke and Pepsi Cola wars did not happen in a free market playing field. But that's a rabbit trail that we don't need to get down. We also need to figure out how Pepsi ended up with submarines during the Cola Wars. That is a topic for another podcast. And I don't mean another episode. That's probably a topic for a different podcast entirely. So let's get back to the point that open source defense is making. They're giving an example of how products reach a level of excellence so that the best product is the highest quality and is the lowest cost. So another example that they give is smartphones, like the iPhone. The iPhone obviously does a whole bunch of different jobs. It's a phone, it's a computer, it's a music player, it's a camera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in the past, rich people bought very different media playback devices and cameras than poor people did. But today, even the super, super rich are more likely to use a smartphone to take pictures than a fancy, expensive camera. Yes, fancy, expensive cameras still exist. They haven't been made obsolete or totally replaced. I myself would love to have an Arri Alexa, and I think that I could get a used Mini for about $100,000 with all of the accessories. That would be cool. And I could very easily buy, well, no, that's not true. I could very easily pick out about $1 million worth of lenses. That seems a little high. If you pushed me, I could narrow it down to like the new S8 Cook Primes. I could get the whole set for like $250,000. So it's, you know, I could be frugal if necessary. But these are specialty devices. These are not luxury devices. The richest people on the planet, like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk, they shoot video with the exact same smartphones that poor people buy, which are the iPhones. iPhones are not the cheapest option, but the government subsidizes poor people buying them, so they're, you know, very common. Even though Android kind of technically has a bigger market share, but the principles are the same. Smartphones in general have completely replaced a whole category or several categories of luxury devices and leveled the playing field in a bunch of different ways, just like Coke did. I guess Android is probably the Coke and iPhones are the Pepsi if we're just looking at market share. But let's get back to guns. Glock is the Coke and Sig is the Pepsi. Now, there's a million upgrades that you can do to your Glock or to your Sig or whatever weapons platform that you've gone with. And of course, there are some people who will argue on the internet that their $4,000 2011 is better than a $500 Glock. But even those people would have to admit that it's only marginally better. It's not eight times better. If you spend eight times the money, you don't actually get eight times the product. The luxury brands that still exist in this space are kind of like exceptions that prove this rule. The polymer frame, double stacked, striker fired Wonder Nines, they're all so close together in their quality that even when we argue Sig versus Glock or Glock versus XD, there's not nearly the disparity in quality that there was even a few years ago. And there are a bunch of reasons for this. Some of these improvements are pure manufacturing technology, because manufacturing technology has matured a lot in the past 50 years. The difference between good and mediocre products used to be very wide, and that has narrowed. And the percentage of good products was very small, and that has grown. Today, there's a lot of products that are top tier, and then the lower tier products are not as far away. And it's kind of interesting to delve into why that is, because today's master craftsmen are just as rare, I would say. But the tools that the non-master craftsmen are using are way better. So a non-master craftsman using a computer-controlled mill can do stuff that only a master craftsman could do in the past, even though you still need that master craftsman to do the work of designing the product and setting it up and programming the mill in the first place. It becomes way more scalable. Computer-controlled heat-treating ovens are pumping out high-quality metals finished the way that a master craftsman would have to do in the past. And the design software that people have, that is an incredible change. Mid-level engineers, guys that have spent maybe weeks or months using Fusion 360 or some other CAD package, are essentially master draftsmen of the past. And that is actually part of what drove the global Coke adoption and distribution in the early 20th century. Now, it wasn't really computerized back then, but those automated chemical mixing machines and the bottling machines meant that every bottle of Coke could be equally good or equally sugary. Actually, Coke back then was better because it was made out of cane sugar. And ironically, if you go to some of the poorer parts of the world, you get better Coke today because there's no high fructose corn syrup subsidies in those spots. But, you know, Andy Warhol couldn't really have visualized that, I guess. But my point is that material science and manufacturing technology lets products be better and cheaper at the same time. That is usually, in the past, a thing that you could have one of or the other, but not both. You may now have better and cheaper and more consistent. But a lot of these improvements that we're talking about in the firearm space aren't actually purely manufacturing technology or material science related. They are actually specific to the weapons industry. They are actually specific to an audience, or rather a customer base that is larger, a larger number of people that want firearms, and a larger number of people that have serious expectations for their firearms because they are better educated or because they have a better defined use case for those firearms. And as a result, we've actually gotten much better at making handguns, for example. We've gotten much better at making AR-15s, even over the last 15 years. Now, AR-15s are not a great example. They're not exactly a Coke, because you can totally spend more money to get a better AR-15 than people who spend not very much money. But again, the gap between excellent and acceptable has significantly shrunk, way more than 20 years ago. And those good AR-15s are cheaper than they were 20 years ago. But anyway, I want to not just steal the point of that open source defense article. But just get back to the premise. They are recommending in that article that the people who are involved in the firearm industry should conscientiously and deliberately try to take products into that Coke level where everything is good and cheap and widely available. And Glocks and Glock knockoffs, I think, are obviously at that level. Glock is, in some ways, a better example of this than Coke even is. Glock is so much the standard and was so disruptive and so effective that, in my opinion, Glock is the new Coke. Not new Coke. We'll actually get to that in a little bit. But my whole adult life, I've basically always been looking for the Glock of whatever. I'm always asking myself, I need to buy a 3D printer. What is the Glock of 3D printers? Is it the Ender 3? Right now, it kind of is. What is the Glock of computers? It used to be the ThinkPad back before Lenovo bought it. What is the Glock of phones? Nokia or Motorola before Lenovo bought them. And I know that a bunch of people will argue that Apple is the Glock of phones. But even though they are market leaders in certain areas, those are a little bit more those luxury devices that have a much smaller market share. Now, they're very disruptive. They've disrupted the consumer electronics market with their features and their marketing and certain trends, walled garden vertical integration services. But Glock disrupted the market by making something that was vastly cheaper and vastly better and making it in such huge quantities that they were able to sell it to 80% of, well, everybody. That is much more like what Coke was doing in the 1950s than what Apple has been doing for the last 20. Coke in the 50s made the cheapest drink, the tastiest soft drink, and they sold it to the widest possible market. So that's not really Apple. That's actually more like Motorola in the 80s, a Nokia in the 90s, and more like Glock. That perfect blend of price, reliability, and support. When the budget option is the very best option, then you have completely nailed it. Which kind of begs the question, would Andy Warhol be singing the praises of Glock if he were around today? I kind of doubt it, but he would probably actually use Glock in some of his silk-screened modern pop art abominations. But that's, beside the point. So if you want to be a Glock or a Coke, if you want to master all of these three things, the price, the quality, and the widespread support, you really need to take full advantage of any new technologies, any new business practices, and new trends. And I actually think that Magpul is a fantastic example of this. They're 100% an example of this if you talk about PMAGs. The Magpul PMAG is the Glock of mags. It might even be the Glock of Glock mags, but it's totally the Glock or the Coke of AR-15 mags. It is the industry standard, no question. The PMAG is the cheapest, and it is the best StayNag mag, and it is the most widely purchased, widely used, etc., etc. And they did that by seeing that there was a need and bringing the very best polymer science and manufacturing technology in-house so that they could make a superior product for less. They set a new standard for magazines. They set a new standard for excellence in the firearm industry. And they did a whole bunch of stuff on the side as well. They provided education. They were really pushing the envelope of gun culture with the art of the dynamic carbine and stuff like that. They were doing stuff for civilians directly. They were doing stuff for the military on the side. They were combining both of these things. I really want to talk more about Magpul, but that is another podcast episode that we should do. I really need to do a little bit more research, but Magpul does not get nearly as much credit for gun culture 3.0 as they should. They don't get nearly as much credit for increasing the professionalism and size and educational capability of the gun industry as they do. So we'll come back to Magpul. That's a conversation worth having. So now we come to research. The question is, how do you actually figure out what is a better product? It's obvious that new technology is going to be able to improve processes and products, but you got to develop some standards so that you know what is actually going to be a better product for the consumer. And one of the lessons that Coke can teach us is that you need to be really careful with your market research, because Coke's quality is really hard to define. It's not really objective. There isn't exactly a standard behind it, because it is just a tasty drink. That's kind of all there is to it. If it's available to everybody and it's cheap and it tastes good, that was enough to really accomplish most of their things that they wanted to. and keep the price down and keep the availability high and keep the consistency really, really good. So nobody ever had a story of getting a bad bottle of Coke. That was their main focus for the first half of the 20th century. And they utterly dominated the globe in the recreational drink category up through the 50s. But by the 1980s, Pepsi was catching up on market share. And Pepsi made these commercials, which I vaguely remember. As a kid, they would film these TV commercials, and they called this the Pepsi Challenge. They would just videotape regular people on the street. They would give them drinks from two masked glasses. And the people would always say that they preferred the drink from glass A. And glass A always turned out to be Pepsi. And glass B was, of course, Coke. This was something that was incredibly popular and effective. And the guys at Coke wondered if this was just a marketing stunt, just kind of some sort of staged TV thing. Or maybe it was all real people on the street, but they edited out anyone who said that they liked glass B. So Coke did their own tests internally and with people outside of the company. And they actually found out that the Pepsi Challenge was 100% legit. People were way more likely to prefer Pepsi when they tasted it in a blind test. So obviously that made Coke panic, and they started developing new Coke, and they developed an entirely new recipe, and they tested it forever and ever and ever. They actually tested new Coke, different recipes of new Coke, with not just thousands, but hundreds of thousands of people, very carefully, very methodically, very scientifically. And eventually they came up with a recipe that tested better than Pepsi across this very wide range of statistically significantly tested people. And so when they rolled out new Coke, they were very confident in their launch of this new recipe, but the market actually hated it. New Coke was terrible. It was a debacle that people remember and talk about to this day, mostly in marketing and market research circles. But man, it was a huge deal. It was the butt of every joke on every talk show. New Coke was a complete flop, so much so that they were forced to bring back classic Coke just to hang on to the market dominance that they had. And to be honest, I'm not actually sure which specific lessons the gun industry should try to take from this new Coke debacle. There have been hundreds and hundreds of papers written on how the testing was bad, why the testing gave them the wrong results, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The main one that I want to focus on, though, is that standards really matter. I know that's something that we talk about on this podcast quite a bit. But the issue was there wasn't really a good standard for better Coke. That's kind of a subjective thing. And the only goals that Coke has that they're trying to achieve are more sales. And so without a standard, that's a really, really hard thing to test. You have to go straight to the mouth of the consumer. And, you know, consumers don't always know what they need. And they don't even always know what they want. They don't always even want what they say they want. I'm actually a perfect example of this. If you were to ask me what radio I wanted, I would pick something that has all the features. But 9 times out of 10, when I grab a radio to actually use it, I actually pick something that does not have very many features at all, not front panel programmable. I just want something to grab and go, even though that's never what I would tell a market researcher. But Coke didn't even have that to go with. It was purely based on taste. It was purely trying to predict what will people buy more of and take home and drink more of. And that's really, really tricky. That's why standards really matter. The goals come from the standards. This is absolutely imperative. Another beverage example would be Guinness. When Arthur Guinness started brewing beer in the 1750s, he had standards that were very important to him. And that allowed him to set goals that went far beyond or be far more specific than just pure financial success. He wanted to do things that would help his fellow Irishmen. So some of them were company specific, like being a very good employer. But nationwide, he wanted a drink that was good enough that it would wean his customers off of whiskey. He was a temperance guy, but he was not a teetotalitarian like the people who started the American Prohibition movement. And he wanted his drink to be affordable enough that everybody could drink it, and he wanted it to be nutritious and healthy. Now, you could argue today that people back then didn't have a great idea of what was nutritious and healthy, but you could say the same thing about people today. I would take a healthy stout over a lot of health drinks today. And, you know, I think that would be a lot better for a lot of different people. But those standards made it really easy for him to make business decisions. It made development of the company and of the product really simple and straightforward because they had standards that they were not going to change. And the new Coke debacle happened, I think, because there just wasn't that framework. Side note, Guinness also needs to be another episode because that is a fascinating development story. And we could drink Guinness while we record that particular podcast. So that would be fun. Third thing that I think Coke teaches a lot of lessons about is marketing. And man, Coke is so good at marketing. It is the king of marketing. And if you read about marketing, you will see so many people writing papers about campaigns that Coke has done. They literally own the color red. There is no other company that uses red in their branding as effectively and as recognizably as Coke does. When you see red in the supermarket aisle, there's a ton of people who use it, but you probably think Coke. They have staked a claim to that territory and they have backed it up. And all of their marketing is very, very focused on nostalgia and a glow and a warm sort of fuzzy feeling and Coke being really, really good and positive, but in a super generic way. I think that their latest campaign, because I don't really keep up, is the sharing one. And that's a perfect example because I would say, yeah, sharing is good. The idea of sharing a Coke with somebody is nice and heartwarming. But what else? Like what goes beyond that? And if you look at some of their marketing campaigns in the past, you can see that they're usually form rather than substance, or they hearken back to substance, but several steps removed. So for example, they were very quick as they were developing their brand in the 40s and 50s to latch on to several important cultural touchstones and kind of co-opt those. So Santa Claus, Norman Rockwell, Norman Rockwell pictures of Santa Claus drinking a Coke. Walt Disney, they were very quick to make sure that they were the exclusive provider of beverages to Disneyland and Disney World. They want to be associated with these cultural touchstones that have the right connotations for their brand, but again, in a vague and fuzzy, abstract way. So just to pull on one of these threads, let's talk about Santa Claus. Santa Claus is Christmas. But of course, he's not really Christmas. He's not really the reason for the season. Santa Claus is several steps removed. Very heart of Christmas, of course, you have the birth of Christ. And then one step removed from that, you have Saint Nicholas, a Christian who follows in the footsteps of the disciples. And then he kind of gets turned into Father Christmas. And Father Christmas kind of gets turned into Santa Claus. And Santa Claus traditionally gets turned into this Norman Rockwell Coca-Cola Santa Claus, this sort of just vague Coke Santaman. But even today, Coke doesn't use Santa Claus. Their Christmas messaging is polar bears, or at least it was not that long ago. Polar bears evoke winteriness, which evokes holiday times, which invokes Santa Claus, which goes back to Christmas without you ever having to say the words. And the reason that Coke can't really have that much substance, the reason they have to have all these abstractions and all these vague sort of emotional triggers is because the product itself doesn't have substance. It's a recreational beverage. It's just sugar water or, you know, high fructose corn syrup water with carbonation and flavor. They don't really have anything to market but the experience, the nice feeling that you get when you get that much sugar in you, or, you know, high fructose corn syrup. And this is actually, in my opinion, the reason that marketing students write so many long papers about Coca-Cola marketing. Yes, it is technically brilliant and well-executed and obviously successful, but it's also really clean and simple. Coke marketing is pure because all that they're marketing is their own brand. They don't ever talk about the efficacy of the product or the purpose of the product or the quality of the product. They just focus on the brand, and it makes it really easy to write highfalutin marketing articles about Coca-Cola's campaigns. And even in the TV show Mad Men, they prove the incredible achievement of the main character Don Draper by having him be the guy responsible for a very important, memorable Coca-Cola campaign. That's the end of the show, and his validation as a genius ad man. That's not accidental. That is the way that every marketing person thinks. But let's get back to the gun industry. This has already been too many rabbit trails. The gun industry does not need to be this vague. A lot of times we are. There's a lot of vague American imagery in a lot of gun marketing. There's tricorn hats, there's eagles, there's flags. There's a lot of signaling without a whole lot of appeal to substance. The good news is that the gun industry doesn't have to do that. It doesn't need to be that abstract. It is selling recreational stuff, yes, but it's also selling tools. So you can harken back to the American founders in a vague way with generic nostalgia and lightly out of focus flintlocks, or you can talk about specific principles and specific quotes. And I'm not saying that we have to, as an industry, move in a specific direction, but different companies are going to need to do different things. And I think everybody could be a little bit more specific. A lot of people are doing a great job of this already. So if you are Cimarron, say, and you sell excellent reproductions of period firearms, that's great. And they have great marketing that talks very specifically about these historical periods, the purposes of appreciating them, the purposes of having an appreciation for specific types of mechanical developments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Fantastic. If you are BCM and you sell modern combat arms for civilians, and you are able to talk about the various needs for those and the reasons why your product is better, that is also fantastic. Now, if you are, just to pick an example, because it was released this week, if you are Patriot Ordnance Factory and you make the Tombstone, which is an old-fashioned lever gun, like Cimarron might sell, but it's made out of black aluminum and it takes curved 20-round 9mm magazines and is covered with all the tactical mounting points that a BCM rifle has, your marketing really needs to be able to say why you did that. And the Patriot Ordnance Factory marketing of the Tombstone does not say why. It vaguely harkens back to the past. And it, by the way, the video looks great. So technically, it's fantastic. And then it talks about why some of the features are good. But why are they together? I'm going to spend more time on this than it probably deserves. But you know that I like old plus new. I love old-fashioned principles and ideologies and time-tested proven wisdom mixed with the most advanced technology and tools. That's literally my whole thing. It kind of defines who I am. But it's really, really hard, and it has to be guided by standards. And you really need to explain why you are doing that. Why are you adding the new stuff and keeping the old stuff at the same time? Now, if you can follow this Coke model of simultaneously making a better product and a cheaper product and a larger quantity of product than your competitors, but you can also do it for a better reason than the pure market share and profitability of Coke, but because you can explain why the product actually empowers and protects the customer, and you can explain why the customer should be empowered and protected, man, that is a really solid, objective purpose. And the marketing can be about that instead of just vague experiential joy and warm, fuzzy bubbles. So my message to the listeners of the podcast and people in the gun industry are be bold, be clear, and use standards to determine what to make and how to sell it. So thank you very much for Brian for giving me the idea of this podcast that has kind of gone a little out of control at this point, and Open Source Defense for giving me the original idea that has been really, really fun to mull over for the last couple of days. And I'm sure that we will talk more about some of the stuff that we will see at SHOT Show next week. And for those of you who are not going to SHOT Show, you're only watching sort of the news and reporting from afar, I guess the homework assignment would be to just look at some of the companies that are involved and the things that they're developing and the ways that they're being marketed, and not to be snide or assume that we could have done a better job than these companies necessarily, but just think through some of the ramifications of products that are kind of aimless and marketed in kind of a vague abstract way versus companies and products that have clear goals and really specific standards guiding their product decisions and their marketing. Again, I think the gun industry is in a really fantastic place right now. There has been an influx of new people and new ideas, customers being educated as to what firearms are and what they are for, and kind of a rediscovery of the founders' principles and an influx of new technological and production methods. That is fantastic. I'm very excited about where things are and where things are headed in the trajectory. And yeah, it's just really interesting to pull back and think about parallels to other industries, even the sugary fizzy water industry. So thank you again, Open Source Defense, for that very thought-provoking quote. And thank you all of you for listening. This episode is not an endorsement of Coke, New Coke, or any Coke-related products. Please drink Guinness instead, because that's the responsible thing to do.